Well, part three of our trilogy guest, David Bloom, tonight. David, of course, proponent in how alcohol can be a gas. And normally when David comes on this program, he speaks about just how we can go into this other form of alternative energy. And he'll do that again tonight. But he's kind of upset. I'll tell you why in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Big Oil. Are these companies beginning to move to take control of independent fuel markets? Let's check in now with David Bloom. David, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, George.
You're not too happy, though, about what Big Oil is up to these days, are you?
Well, I don't think anyone would be too happy to have Big Oil control not only our energy, but our land and food, too. I'd say that would be a pretty negative development.
David, tell us a little bit about what you're hearing out there with regards to Valero, a company that may want to pick up a company or two.
Well, yeah, it's really outrageous. For the last year, alcohol fuel has been hammered in the press by just an unceasing flow of propaganda about why, you know, we shouldn't go to ethanol for this, or we shouldn't go to ethanol for that. And it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz saying, don't look at the man behind the curtain, you know, don't look at the truth. And as we see this develop over the year, we see there's a purpose to it. The crushing of alcohol fuel in the public mind has been part of a big strategy for the oil companies to take over the alcohol fuel industry and get rid of the competition.
How rapidly are they moving in this direction?
Well, this is, you know, been building for quite a while, and I've been trying to warn, you know, both the new administration and people in agriculture for the last year that where we were heading was a place where alcohol fuel would become the newest plaything of Big Oil. So we had worried that it was all going to happen before Inauguration Day, back during the chaos of the change of administration. But the alcohol fuel industry has shown it has a little more moxie and a little more resilience than that. So it's just now beginning to go into effect where maybe 25% of our alcohol producing capacity has been idled by, you know, the combination of corn prices being driven up by the oil companies and also driving down of alcohol prices in the market. So we're looking at maybe 25% of the industry going bankrupt over the next 1 to 2 months. And starting about a week, I guess that's 2 weeks ago now, oil companies have started making offers to buy the ethanol plants out of bankruptcy.
David, when you were on with me just a few months ago, it seemed like this push toward ethanol and the use of alcohol for gas was beginning to literally pick up steam. What happened? I mean, how did the bottom seem to fall out?
Well, you know, I warned about this in my book, Alcohol Could Be a Gas, that the whole industry of alcohol fuel is really vulnerable to being gamed. Kind of like back when California, you know, had rolling blackouts and Enron had pulled a lot of the games in the energy market that set up for fleecing the state for many billions of dollars. The same huge forces were at work in alcohol fuel. What we saw in 2006 was an enormous bursting out of alcohol fuel around in the United States. Literally, billions and billions and billions of dollars were being invested in alcohol fuel because it was a good bet. Back in 2006, alcohol plants were making 100% return on investment every year.
That's phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Yeah. And what that was about is, you know, corn has always been a very cheap commodity, and alcohol was being made almost exclusively from corn and still is today. Now, you might think of the alcohol industry as kind of a way of getting rid of surplus corn because for many, many years, in fact, decades now, we've been so productive as a farming nation that we've had just a sea of excess corn around. So it was natural that the alcohol fuel industry back under Jimmy Carter started really cranking up its production. And now we produce many billions of gallons of alcohol a year just from the essentially surplus corn, way beyond what we need for feeding our animals and producing our milk and all that kind of thing. So, you know, that's really was a pretty good way of using up the surplus grain that we were producing.
Sure.
And under Jimmy Carter, we realized during the last Arab oil embargo what you know, just how important it was for us not to be fully dependent on oil, because it could really ravage our economy like it did in the late 70s, yep, early 80s, yep, when we waited in line, our fuel was rationed. And there are people who would like to see us back there again in the oil industry. And the thing that stands in their way is alcohol fuel. So you're right. I'm, you know, hopping mad that people have let, you know, the situation get to where it is today, where the oil companies can just go out and victimize their competition with no interference by anyone, you know, no one in the FTC, no one in the antitrust division. And basically we're allowing the only thing that stands between us and complete dependence on oil to be rubbed out.
David, the fact that the price of gasoline has gone down, down, and down over the last several months, was that done by design to get our minds off these alternative fuels?
Well, you know, it used to, back in the 80s, Saudi Arabian Sheikh Yamani used to say, the Stone Age did not end for lack of stone, and the Oil Age won't end for lack of oil. But if we go ahead and let the United States and other Western countries develop alternatives, if we keep the price high too long, then it will only take them 7 to 10 years to replace their, you know, dependence on oil. So that was, you know, in 1980, these kinds of comments were being made. The oil company and companies in OPEC totally understand that if they keep prices consistently high for too long, we're going to use our ingenuity and our entrepreneurship, and we're going to go ahead and replace what's costing us too much money.
Exactly.
I mean, it's an old saying, you know, there's no such the best cure for high prices is high prices.
They want to tick us off with high prices, but not that much, do they?
Well, yeah, and what's been going on is this enormous investment into alternative fuels. So to dry that up, it's not necessary that you permanently, you know, drop the price of fuel, but just make the price of fuel a volatile item. Because nothing makes investors more nervous than lack of stability. So if alcohol is up, you know, 1 month, and then 4 months later it's way, way down, and then it goes back up, it doesn't matter if it goes back up, because just the going up and down is enough to make investors pull out of the market. So yet Bill Gates putting in billions of dollars basically into alcohol fuel because he thought it was a good bet.
T. Boone Pickens and the windmills.
And all of that stuff. And as soon as the price of energy goes down, people get nervous about investing in it. And with alcohol fuel, we were looking to permanently replace most of the oil in the United States within 5 to 10 years, the way things were going in 2006. So the oil companies couldn't let that go on. And we're looking at the results of that today.
Did you anticipate that, David? Did you see that kind of an attack on the push to get these alternative fuels?
Well, you know, both of us did, George. You and I talked a lot about this before the election. And, you know, it's been a pattern for quite a while where the price of oil, quite cynically, is always dropped before an election as the oil companies make deals with both sides in an election to try to get favors that they will be able to cash in on after the election's over. So we put a chart on our website over at Alcohol Can Be a Gas, where you can see that, say, in 2006, the price of oil, this was, you know, the prior election cycle before this last one we just had, where the price of oil started down in August, cratered on November 7th, and then cranked right back up afterwards. And in a few months later, you were just as high as you were before the election. That's, we're in that process right now. I mean, we've been talking about, oh gosh, it's so cheap compared to what it was last summer. But stand back a little bit and look at when the price of gas was cheapest. It was right on December 19th. Since then, the price of gasoline has gone up 50% since the price was at on December 19th. A few cents this week, a few cents next week.
Exactly.
And we're already back up 50% above what we were at on December 19th, yet the price of oil hasn't gone up hardly at all. The price of gasoline and the stuff they sell us has gone up 50%, but the cost of the raw material has stayed pretty much unchanged since December 19th. So that's a pretty good indicator that whatever oil is worth isn't the same as what they sell us in terms of our fuel prices. So they're not linked necessarily. They can charge us whatever they want because there's only so much refining capacity and there's only so much delivery that's being made. So you could argue whether we're actually running out of oil, say in a peak oil scenario, or whether we're just getting as much oil as they want to provide for us. And so in either case, we Americans, and everyone around the world for that matter, are really at the beck and call of the oil companies. And there's only one way that we can stop that from going on, and that's by stopping giving them our money.
What's also interesting, though, David, people now are at a point where they're preserving their personal capital, and I'm talking about investors. What could have been easy a few years ago in terms of getting some of these ethanol plants built, I think these investors now are holding back. It's going to be difficult to attract new capital. What happens as some of these places begin to close or can't get financing?
Well, you know, it's just really terrifying, George, when you look at the whole effect of what's going on. Because I think the big example of this, what we just wrote about and has been published around the country, is what happened to Verisun. Verisun was a huge alcohol fuel company, but unlike a lot of the earlier ones, instead of being owned by farmers, which most of the alcohol plants were up until a few years ago, this was owned by investors. In other words, people saying, wow, look at that return on investment in alcohol and pouring money into it.
Private company or public at the time?
Do you know?
I can find out.
I know. They started off private. They went IPO 4 or 5 years ago.
Are they still out there in the market, or they go belly up?
Well, they just went bankrupt.
Okay. So the shareholders are all, you know, out of luck.
Yeah, that's not only them, but here's the thing that's really frightening. And this is kind of the key to what's going on, or to understanding what's going on, is that the farmers sold their corn to Verisun on contract, on a futures contract, meaning Verisun said, okay, we'll buy your corn in
at a later
January
date,
2009.
Lock in that price.
And we'll pay you plenty for it because right now the price of corn is up and we'll pay you $7 a bushel when, you know, 2 years ago corn was $2 a bushel or $2.50. So the farmers said, fine, if you'll buy it for that, we'll sell it to you for that. So now this bankruptcy comes along. Now, normally, when someone goes bankrupt and they have futures contracts,
they're gone, right?
Well, normally, no. They come first.
And
And those get paid off before other creditors. But in this case, the federal bankruptcy court is making the first-time exception, saying, oh, well, if an alcohol company goes bankrupt, the buyers don't have to honor the futures contract to the farmers. So this is a new development. So now what happens is we go ahead and see Valero, who's just made the offer for Verisun, buy the alcohol plant. They renege on paying the farmers. The farmers don't get to get out of their debts. So now Valero not only gets to buy the alcohol plant for pennies on the dollar, the farmers go bankrupt because they were waiting to get paid for the corn, and now Valero can buy the farms. So the frightening thing is you could see oil companies starting almost immediately owning everything from the seed through their subsidiaries like Monsanto, et cetera, all the way through the fuel at the pump. And they would control our food supply, our land, and our energy. And that is a formula for worldwide fascism.
Oh, my gosh. And so and here it is. They're down now at 28 cents a share at their high of 10. And it says Verisun Energy to sell assets to Valero for $280 million in a tight credit market. They're all done.
Well, they are and they aren't. You know, basically, this is the
production facilities, by the way, in South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, and Indiana, it says.
That's right. And there are many more. These are the ones that they've offered on so far. Verisun has, I believe, another, it's got to be 6 or 8 other plants. But they're not the only ones going bankrupt. There's almost 40 plants at this point out of 180, 190 plants that are either on the verge of bankruptcy or temporarily closed, waiting for things to change. So we're looking at maybe a quarter or more of the alcohol industry could fall prey to this oil company strategy. And the strategy is a bit involved, which we kind of explain the whole thing. But I don't want us to get too far into it and then have to, like, lose concentration. But the key thing has to do with how futures work and how this was manipulated. A lot of folks, you know, probably never heard of what a futures contract is. And I think the only public education on that has been that movie, Trading Places, with Eddie Murphy. I don't know if you...
Sure. It was a great movie.
Yeah, I remember. So Eddie Murphy was this relatively uneducated city guy.
Yeah.
And these two commodities brokers say, you know, they have a bet between them. Anybody can learn how to be a futures trader, one of them says. The other guy says, oh, no, you have to go to the best schools. You have to be a brilliant mind. And so they have a $1 bet between them if they can train somebody who's never had any exposure to this world to even understand it and trade in it. So Eddie Murphy gets picked, you know, at random for this. And so they teach him how to be a futures trader. So as we mentioned, the idea actually starts off as a way where farmers can make sure that they don't get hosed at the time of harvest. So you're growing corn or you're growing oranges or you're growing whatever. And you say, you know, come October, come next, you know, harvest season, you know, I don't want to be completely at the mercy of the market. So I'm going to sell some of my crop now. Let's say you're a grain farmer and you can sell it to Kellogg's, you know, somebody who uses grain for a little lower price. But at least I know it's sold and I've got part of my crop in the bank. So Kellogg's offers you a little less than they think they would have to buy it for next October because, hey, they're buying it early. They should get a deal. That's fair. So Kellogg offers you, instead of, say, $2.50 a bushel, they offer you $2 or $2.25. And you say, well, it's not a lot of money, but at least I got some of it sold. So that idea is a pretty good stabilizing influence on the price of corn, and that was the purpose of the commodities market, is to reward early buyers with a little bit of price. Now, here's where it gets convoluted. Let's say you're not Kellogg's, but you're a guy with a bunch of money.
Yep.
And you know that Kellogg's is going to need grain in October. So you go to a farmer and you say, I'll buy grain from you at X price. And so the farmer sells it to you. Now, you have no way of using all this grain. You're just, you know,
you're speculating.
You're a speculator. You're a gambler. Your goal is to buy it cheap from the farmer. And then when Kellogg's needs it, sell it to Kellogg's for a good markup. Buy cheap,
right.
Sell high.
Yep.
Well, that is all great if you've got a lot of money and it goes the way you expect. But it could be, for instance, that there's too much corn at the time that you want to sell it.
And what if Kellogg says, hey, we don't need it from you?
That's exactly right, George. So in Trading Places, the way this thing worked was Eddie Murphy found out that his bosses had secretly obtained the crop report in advance, the USDA report that would say what the crop of oranges was like to be like for the year.
Right.
So what they thought was, if they got a report back from the USDA saying, oh, the weather was bad in the winter and the...
Going to be a shortage?
There'll be a shortage, exactly. A shortage of those oranges. So now we'll buy up all the oranges we can get, and then when the orange juice guys want it, we'll be in the driver's seat. We'll charge them a fortune. So they steal the report, and Eddie Murphy switches it. He switches one that says, you know, everything's
normal
for one that says there'll be a shortage of oranges. So his bosses go out there and they buy all these orange contracts, and the price of oranges go way up because everyone can smell something going on.
Something's happening.
All these
sales
get made. So, but they keep buying them because they're going to corner the market. Well, then the real report comes out, and of course they find out that they were hoodwinked and that there's going to be plenty of oranges. So just like you mentioned, George, they have to dump those contracts, and when they do, the price goes down, they lose their tail, and Trading Places. Eddie Murphy's on top, and his boss is broke.
And somebody there won the bet. When we come back with David Bloom, we'll find out how you can make maybe your own alcohol fuel. We'll be back. Indeed, indeed. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines with David Bloom, our very special guest, this part of our trilogy night. I kind of like this. And when we come back, though, more to talk with David about, plus some tips on what you can do to get your own alcohol fuel. It's a fascinating discussion because he's going to talk about some kits available and what you can do if you want to do it. We'll be back. Davis, tell us now how we can do this at home. And, you know, it's not one of those, say, hey, kids, don't do this at home. This is relatively safe, isn't it?
Well, yeah, making, as I've said before, making alcohol is mankind's second oldest profession. We've been doing this a long time, and it's something that can be done on the individual or home scale or on the farm scale or even more intriguingly on the small business scale.
Sure, and it's not moonshine.
Well, it is moonshine.
Oh, it is moonshine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Same kind, same process.
It is, although when we use our brains nowadays, we're using technology that we've borrowed from the oil company in being able to make alcohol of 192 proof or better on the first pass. And that's good enough to use as fuel right out of the still without having to do any other steps if we want. So the old moonshine stills used to only make about 100 proof, or half alcohol, half water.
Okay.
But a little more modern technology that we use nowadays is still very simple, and we're able to put out as much as pretty much as is theoretically possible, getting the last bit of water out, the last 4%, using distillation turns out to require a separate step, which we also can do on a relatively simple basis, but it's not necessary unless you happen to live in, oh gosh, North Dakota, where it gets to, way, way, way below zero.
Yeah.
If you get more than 22 degrees below zero, you have to get the last bit of alcohol, water out of the alcohol to prevent it from separating from gas if you go back and forth between gas and alcohol.
Okay.
But if you're just running on plain alcohol, heck, you can make it yourself. It's good to 150 below zero without having any problems. And if you live where it's 150 below zero, you've got other problems.
So. And the sources. Now, I recall that you like to use cattails, right?
Well, cattails are one of many good crops.
And let's point this out. We're not talking about the tail of cats. We're talking about the plant. Got to say that.
Well, yeah, they call them cattails because we've all seen this plant growing in ditches. It looks like a stick with a hot dog on the end.
Yeah.
That hot dog end kind of resembles, a fluffy tail from a cat. And those crops have the same starch in them, basically, that corn does. And that's what we make alcohol from, is only the starch or the sugar. There's other crops, like, for instance, sweet sorghum, which looks a lot like corn, but has a sugarcane-like stalk, which is full of sugar. And lots of other waste materials, too, that we can make alcohol from. We're working really hard right now with the American Corn Growers Association to grow many different crops, because the corn growers are tired of being jerked around like they have been the last 2 years by the oil companies and by the grain companies. And they want independence. They want out from under having the price manipulated for their crop, having nothing to do with actual supply and demand, but strictly with speculators and, again, oil companies trying to use the very market that they're involved in to steal their land. So what we're working with them for is to do many different crops like you're talking about, George. And we're going to do a series of workshops with American Corn Growers Association across the Midwest this year. We just did the first one we put on, our first two-day workshop in Normal, Illinois. And about half the people who showed up at that workshop, George, were your listeners. So
I like that.
I got to thank you for helping us get the word out, because Coast people are on the front edge of whatever change happens in this country, and the farmers and entrepreneurs that showed up at this workshop were a great group. So we can expect more of farmers wanting to get out of corn and into other crops, but some of the participants had other things in mind. One of them had a company where he made pretzels. Well, gosh, pretzels are made out of, the wheat starch, and so he had all these broken pretzels that he threw away every year. Now he's going to make alcohol from them.
You're kidding me.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Waste not, want not, right?
Yeah, we have people come from as far away as Florida and Connecticut and Pennsylvania, all the way out to the middle of Iowa, Illinois. So in Florida, we're seeing people, there's a disease going through the orange groves in Florida right now, which is a big problem. So we're seeing orange growers first having to, take bad oranges and make alcohol with them, but they're having to tear out the orange trees, and it's looking like where a lot of them want to go is to grow sweet sorghum, and that will give them more profit than they were making from the oranges, making both alcohol fuel, and a variety of great byproducts. Now, you can do this at home just as well as you could on the farm scale. By byproducts, I'm talking about things like, for instance, if you're using corn or whatever for making your alcohol, you only use the starch. So you can make your alcohol for, let's say the pretzel guy using starch, he can make his alcohol for about 30 cents a gallon using his waste pretzels, and instead of having to pay to get rid of it.
How about the guy at home, if he's starting from scratch? And then we'll talk about the distillers in a second.
Well, sure. One of my favorite stories, of course, is donuts, because what's a donut? It's basically starch and 10 teaspoons of sugar per donut, and cops can only eat so many, so they have to throw the rest away. And using donuts, we can make alcohol for about 20, 25 cents a gallon. So the way we do that is we cook the donuts up. We add some enzymes, the same enzymes that beer makers use that you find in barley. Barley has two enzymes that break the starch down into sugar that naturally occur when the barley sprouts. So we could use those for barley, for enzyme sources, or you can actually buy commercial enzymes. But, you know, if you're worried about things kind of falling apart, then being able to sprout barley is a really good thing to know how to do, because then you don't have to buy enzymes from any big companies. So you dissolve the starch into sugar. You add yeast, the same yeast that make bread or wine or beer. It's all the same yeast. And it eats the sugar, makes the alcohol, so you end up with donut wine. About 12 or 13% alcohol. When you reach that much alcohol, the yeast keel over dead drunk. You know, it's kind of like a microcosm of the planet.
Literally,
you're polluting the planet, eventually you choke on your own waste. That's what happens to the yeast. And then once you've got that 12%, 13% alcohol to purify it, to be able to run it in your car, well, you go ahead and distill the alcohol out of the wine. So now you're making brandy or whiskey, basically. And that's the whole process, although, of course, in that brief description is a whole book worth of details on how to do it well and do it right and do it cheaply. So we go over all that, and alcohol can be a gas for a wide variety of crops, from oddball things like in the Southwest. We have a lot of listeners in Texas, of course, from your show that write to us a lot. And down there they've got mesquite, you know, which is a tree that grows all over.
Right.
There.
Now, can you mix this in with the gasoline, or can you just, let's say that your tank is empty, can you just dump this alcohol fuel right in the tank? Do you need to convert your engine at all?
Well, you know, one of the things that you and I had a great time breaking through in this country last summer was the fact that you can put alcohol in your current car up to 50% without making any changes. In other words, alcohol mixes with gas just fine. And you can actually buy it at the pump, even if you don't make it yourself, at what we call E85 stations.
That's right.
And this is, you know, pumps that sell 85% alcohol right at the pump. There's a couple of thousand of them in the U.S. So this is the point, when I mentioned this before, and I hesitate to do it again because you crushed my server last time I mentioned
it. And we will crush it again tonight.
All right, so let's see if George can crush my server again. So the point was, on our site at alcoholcanbeagas.com, you can click on the link that tells you where all the alcohol stations are and find out if there's one near you. And you can actually go ahead tomorrow and buy yourself a gallon of alcohol at the pump, put it in the tank, and you'll see for yourself that.
Straight from the pump right into the tank.
Right into your
1 gallon.
Yeah. And nothing happens. In other words, everything is just fine. Well, the next time you go to that pump, put in 2 gallons, you know, when you fill up your car, and then 3, and then 4. And when you get up to around 50-50, you're going to say, my gosh, it runs better than it did before. You actually have a little more horsepower and a little more kick. And
it's cleaner.
It's 98% cleaner than gasoline, so you're cleaning up the air. And what that also means is, of course, it's cleaning up your engine. Your oil stops turning black because that's the carbon that normally goes from unburned gasoline, and you end up burning cooler than gasoline, so your engine actually has less heat stress and lasts longer.
What's the E85 going for right now?
Right now it's going for about 30 cents cheaper than gasoline, which is not a huge difference. But here's the thing. The price of gasoline by this summer like it's going to go back early
up.
In the show.
It's going to go back up.
It's going to go way back up. And you've got places like Morgan Stanley and Citigroup buying or renting oil tankers right now. I mean, this is not like some fantastical story. This was reported
with our money, probably, right?
Excuse me?
With our money.
Well, yeah, with our bailout money, right?
Yeah.
So they're buying renting these tankers for $75,000 a day, but they hold millions of barrels of oil, and they're buying the oil now at $30-odd a barrel.
And it's in the tanker.
It's in the tanker, just parked, and then in a few months, they'll just pull it into the refineries in the Gulf when it's $150 or $200 a barrel, and they'll make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars profit. So, and, you know, like I say, this is not controversial. This isn't, you know, some wild theory. This is reported in the business news section of the Bloomberg site. So it's not, this is like futures trading, but literally holding the oil.
How much does a good distiller go for?
Well, you know, what we should.
And it's based on gallons, right, that you want to produce?
Sure. So if you want to make yourself 100 gallons, you know, basically in a day, 8-10 gallons per hour, you can build one of those for $1,500 if you know how to weld. And now you've got something that'll make you several thousand gallons of fuel a year.
Can't you get a kit that, you know, most of it's put together already?
You know, that's in the process of happening. There's several companies that I've been talking to.
Man, what's taking them so long, Dave? You would think that this would have happened a long time ago.
Well, you know, I used to manufacture these distilleries that produced 100 to 200 gallons a day back in the 80s. But, gosh, the price of gas went down.
You know? Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, and so right now the price of gas is down. So some of the companies that were ready to, you know, go full on in July have had to, like...
They held back.
Help hold back a little bit. And I just came back from Florida where an innovative company is working on putting together a 1 million gallon per year distillery. So this would fit in a small barn or a really big garage. And basically, you know, this would be the basis of a really solid small business of fueling, you know, 1,000 people in your community with all the fuel they need in a year. Most of us use about 1,000 gallons of, you know, fuel a year.
What kind of licensing do you need to do this, not on a commercial basis, but just for yourself?
Well, you know, in the book, we have the permit that you get from the revenuers, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms folks, and they require you to fill out a free permit, which lets you make 5,000 gallons of fuel a year without paying any money to the federal government. Now, you know, since you and I went on the air in July, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people have been deluged, so to speak. Not with alcohol, but with people calling saying, okay, I want my permit. And get this, they're telling people, don't even apply. We can't process your permit, you know, in advance. Just build your still and let us know when you're done. So,
I mean, this is
a riot. This is like saying, well, go build a skyscraper. When you're done, you know, apply for the building permit.
Yeah, and then try to get tenants for it.
Yeah. Yeah, nowadays. Except I think you'd have people lining up to buy alcohol from you because I got to tell you, there's nothing more disgusting than putting gasoline in the tank. It's like you just know every time you're doing it, you're sending your money to a Geneva bank account for some oil company, and you're sending it out of your community forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Catherine, you know, our good friend Catherine Austin Fitz,
yep.
You know, we talk about this where you swipe your card through the pump, and there goes your paycheck over to Switzerland, and now your community doesn't have that money anymore.
David, when you're making the alcohol fuel, do you physically have to sit there and watch this thing 24/7?
Oh, no. No. Even before, you know, back in the 80s when we first started doing this, we could use simple thermostatic valves to control the alcohol distillery without having to sit there. In other words, you have to control the temperature in the distilling column so you get pure alcohol. Nowadays, we expect that several of the companies that we're talking to that are going to build smaller stills will be using, you know, very simple computer circuits to be able to sense the temperature and control the thing. So the thing, once you get it started and up and running, it runs the rest of the day without you having to fuss with it. It's just like if you're on a farm, there are chores you do where you check in on something every few hours. It'll be, it, operates like that.
And there are companies out there that will sell you the material to use the cattails or whatever you're going to use as your source.
Well, no, you can buy corn, of course, and then you use the byproducts from the purchased corn.
Right.
To,
where do you recommend people go generally? I mean, people who live in the city, where are they going to go?
Well, the city is the best place because that's where all the waste products are. So, for instance, some of my readers have used waste soda pop syrup. So when they have a bottling plant in town, when they're making up the soda syrup, the first part of the batch and the last part of the batch don't quite have the right, proportion of ingredients as the machines all rev up. So they have to throw the heads and tails away, and it's basically like molasses, but it's made of corn syrup. So some of these bottling plants might haul off 100, 200 tons a day of soda syrup, and they love it if you'll take it off their hands.
Huh. Now, do you provide lists of companies around the country that are suppliers of these materials?
Well, not officially suppliers. This is what you got to realize in America, like we buy ingredients, we make the product, we throw away the waste. Well, in my world, there is no such word as waste.
No, you use everything.
Yeah, I use everything. So,
I wonder what your Thanksgiving meals are like. My God. use the head, the liver, the gizzards, everything.
Oh,
you?
My God. Yeah. The interesting thing about making alcohol is you get really good at scrounging and using stuff. So we've had people use waste apple juice during apple pressing season or waste fruit that doesn't make the grade. We can all kinds of bakery products. And the poison peanut thing. This was really fascinating because the peanuts that went out there that were having to be recalled. Well,
the peanut butter? Yeah.
Well, but it wasn't just that.
No, they also had some bars and stuff. That's right.
Well, that's mostly starch.
Salmonella.
You have a little bit of peanuts and millions of tons of starch being returned. If you had an alcohol plant and that recall goes on, you just say, oh, by the way, just drop that over here. I'll only charge you $50 a ton to dump it at my place.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, and there's always stuff like that that's on recall.
And wash your hands.
Well, wash your hands, right. Well, of course, when you cook this stuff to make alcohol, it's all sterile.
It kills it anyway.
Yeah, and, here you are taking in waste granola bars. You're making 100 gallons for every pickup truck full of granola bars they bring you.
Now, what do you do with the waste from the distilled process?
Well, of course, in this case, it's sterile. It's been boiled, for hours.
Yeah.
Distilling the alcohol. So it's perfectly safe to use for fertilizer. It's good to use for animal feed.
Can you throw it away if you want to?
Well, gosh, I can't do that, George. It's against my religion
no, I
to
know.
Throw it away
you,
if I can make money
from
it.
But don't forget now, city folks, David, where we got some limitations here.
All right, so here's how some city things happen. There's alcohol plants that take waste products like soda pop syrup, and they go ahead and take a look at what it costs for you to put that in the sewer. Because the sewer guys charge you for how much oxygen is used up by the decomposition
right,
of the
right.
waste. So here's a company that will take it, make alcohol with it, uses up all the starch, and then they put their waste into the city sewer, which is far less polluting than how it came into the plant. So they charge the difference between the two to the people they're hauling it away from. So you get paid to haul it away, and you're helping clean up and make the sewer system better. So that's better than buying a raw material if you can get paid to haul it away, which is, the way I like to do business.
Pretty fascinating, David Bloom. Now we keep you for questions next hour on Coast to Coast AM.